This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And as we do, we come to you every week, Friday at 9 o'clock or thereabouts. Today's guest, Philip van Niekerk. That name will be familiar to many South Africans. He used to be the editor of The Mail and Guardian here, and he has years and years experience working in and around Africa. He's got awards by the handful, been a foreign correspondent for British newspapers, and he has a business, an opportunity where he advises foreign investors on their circumstances in Africa. And now he's also the editorial director of something called Scrolla Africa, which I'll ask him to explain a little bit. He is an occasional contributor rather, to the Daily Maverick. I have to disclose that, I guess. And I see his name fairly frequently as a discussant on Africa issues in many of the think tanks in and around Washington, where they have seminars and conferences and colloquies on what's happening in Africa and what's happening with America in Africa and so forth. And I thought that given the news and given the circumstances over the last number of weeks, that it would be appropriate to have someone who knows a fair bit about Africa and the Sahel and Niger and Sudan to put this not simply in a minute-by-minute discussion of what's happening in each place, but larger context, bigger picture. What does this all mean, that stretch of countries that runs from near the west coast of Africa on through to Sudan? And so I guess the first question really to you is, first tell me just for a minute, what Scrolla Africa is, and then go into that question about the Sahel and the former Francophone countries and the revolt in Niger and Sudan. And what does this all mean? Philip, welcome.
Hi, Brooks. Hi. So Scrolla.Africa is a mobile-only news platform it's kind of a tabloid news platform for ordinary folks. You know, we started in South Africa, but we've also got a operation in Nigeria. We go out in Zulu, we go out in Afrikaans, we go out in Hausa. We have more than 1 million readers, we're so far, and we're hoping to grow and expand and, throughout the continent, frankly, and, you know, just find a new way of reaching a new audience, younger, perhaps people living in far out places, parts of South Africa, you know, that are kind of ignored and outside of and neglected and outside of, you know, what the mainstream media kind of concerns itself with in the big cities. So it's really kind of an attempt to, you know, democratize media, if you like, as much as we can. And by giving it a sort of compelling, you know, kind of newsy, you know, there's a lot of sport. There's a lot of, you know, we go for popular culture, you know, who's kind of doing stuff in music and so on. So, you know, and then we do tend to sort of have a lot of crime and, you know, the usual stuff, but, it's actually sort of reaching a different audience. Let's put it that way.
Well, 1 million readers is nothing to be sneezed at.
No. And you know, with very, very slim resources, we've managed to build that up. And we sort of recognize, you know, that's where the future is. That's where Africa is, you know, and people, nobody's really trying hard enough to kind of reach those people, to bring them into some kind of sense of community. You know, they're at the moment, they're kind of out there. They're, you know, we're trying to be as inclusive as possible.
Yeah, news starved, but news interested. And they want to be part of the, what we used to call back in the dark ages, the wired world. Mm-hmm. That goes back a few years, that phrase, doesn't it? Let's segue a little bit toward the Sahel region and Niger and Sudan. South Africans, I think, tend to mostly ignore it because it's far away theoretically and it doesn't affect them, although some of it does and some of it will. And I think people need to be attentive to what's happening. Your view?
No, I think correct. I mean, it certainly has highlighted some of the kind of geopolitical tensions, which are common throughout the continent at this point. But just to sort of row back a little bit, I mean, generally speaking, you know, the Sahel is a sort of very poor the southern part of the Sahel is kind of arid. The northern part is desert. You know, there aren't that many kind of resources. There's sort of gold in Mali, gold in Burkina Faso, uranium in Niger. But generally, I mean, these are very poor, essentially countries that, you know, when the British colonized Nigeria, you know, they said they weren't interested in colonizing the Sahel. It just wasn't worth it. And, I think, Lord Lugard, who colonized Nigeria at the time said he would leave it to the French cockerel to go and peck around in the desert was his kind of saying. Now, the reason why it has some kind of geopolitical resonance today is that of all the sort of colonial powers that, kind of exited mostly Africa in the 1960s, the British, et cetera, the French sort of stayed under General de Gaulle, who was president in the 1960s. They framed a policy called France-Afrique, which was an attempt to basically create a neo-colonial empire out of their colonial empire. And in many ways, that has held until very recently, which is, you know, which has allowed, you know, the French to get oil out of places like Congo, Brazzaville and Cameroon and, to get natural resources out of other places. And, I guess what has happened in the last couple of years is that this military empire as well, because they've intervened many times in conflicts in Africa to ensure that their people stay in power. This empire is sort of disintegrating. So Central African Republic, Mali, and then Burkina Faso, and now Niger, basically, you know, kind of moved out of the French orbit, if you like. And in a way, this is coming at the same time as the French president Macron is talking about a kind of a new kind of relationship between France and the Francophone African countries. Now, the difficulty that he has is as he tries to put a more European face, a more kind of partnership-based relationship with Niger, is that Wagner, which is the, you know, the mercenary forces that are also very active in the social media and propaganda space and disinformation, has found the sort of faltering French empire as a sort of weak point of, in Africa and a point to kind of insert themselves. And at the same time, you have a jihadist revolution that's been happening throughout the Sahel. You have jihadist groups, Al-Qaeda more in the north. You've got ISIS sort of further in the south. You've got Boko Haram across the border in Niger and in Nigeria. In fact, you've got all three of those elements at play in Niger that are challenging and creating a lot of misery and a lot of suffering, actually. And in many ways, the coups in Mali and Burkina Faso emerged out of the failure of the previous governments to actually get on top of this problem with the jihadists and to say, look, we're going to try and do this better. Part of the way of doing that better is to kick out the French and bring in the case of Mali, bring in the Wagner. It hasn't gone too well, actually, because the jihadists are extending their range as we speak. And in fact, the coup in Niger has created even more complications because there was one country where, you know, in the Sahel, where they actually were starting to get on top of the insurgent problem.
We're going to take a quick station break and then hold that thought for a minute, and we can talk more specifically about Niger and the coup and what this portends. But we're speaking now with Philip von Niekerk, Scrola Africa editorial director and head of Calabar Africa Consulting Company and formerly the editor of the Mail and Guardian, now living in Washington. And this is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Philip von Niekerk, Scrola Africa, and formerly the Mail and Guardian, and also Calabar Consulting, and a man who knows his way around Africa in both the small and the large aspects of questions. And just before the break, I asked him what we were beginning to go into the more into the details of Niger and how the country seemed to be, unfortunately, it had gotten on top of some of the insurrectionist groups and then the coup. And Philip, I interrupted you just at that point, and please continue.
Okay. Well, I've been trying to sort of sketch this bigger sort of geopolitical story, but in fact, it's important to understand that the genesis of the coup is not necessarily, has actually probably nothing to do with the bigger story, despite the way it's been portrayed. Largely because of the amount of disinformation and fake news that's out there. And that is that the former president called Mohamed Bazoum, he is actually the current president according to the constitution, was about to fire the head of his presidential guard, a man called Abdurrahman Chiani. And General Chiani didn't like the fact that he was about to lose his job. And so you have this rather awful reason for a coup, which is that the man didn't want to get fired, so he fired the man who was going to fire him. But of course, that's not a good enough reason to, you know, to say, wow, you know, look, we have a revolution. And so they had to kind of build into it a bigger story, a different kind of narrative. He's still holding the president, his wife, and the president's son hostage in the presidential compound, at gunpoint. He's got 60 soldiers around them. This is, so we're talking really about a hostage scenario and not simply a coup. And he threatened, when the military, it took them a whole day to kind of join the coup, when they initially, you know, they weren't sort of like part of it, but he said, look, I'm going to create a bloodbath. I'm going to kill the president unless you sort of fall in line. And of course, many of them were prepared to fall in line. Some of the top generals weren't happy with the fact that the president was about to start investigating them for a very corrupt arms deal. So that's a background, which is sort of very, very localized kind of issues that then get built up into, you know, through this very, very effective propaganda into, oh, well, we're throwing off the chains of the French. You know, this is a revolution against French neocolonialism. This is, so it's sort of given some other, a higher purpose. And now we are, the whole world and all the way down to South Africa, people are saying, yes, go for it. You know, and they're supporting what is in fact a military coup that doesn't really have much justification or legitimacy. But then you have the West African states, the economic community of West African states, ECOWAS, who've been watching as one by one, we've seen these coups happen through West Africa. So we've seen, you know, the coups in Guinea, two in Mali, two in Burkina Faso, coup in Sudan. So all the way from literally from the Atlantic coast to the Red Sea, you now have countries that are ruled by military going across a band, not on the Atlantic coast itself, but going across a band across west to east, across Africa, run by military governments that have taken power, you know, through the barrel of a gun, literally. And for the countries down on the coast, you know, some very big significant ones, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Senegal, Ghana, this is a very disturbing development, not only because, you know, if you accept this coup contagion, it's going to come to you at some point as well, potentially, but also because Mali and Burkina Faso have lost control essentially of the war against jihadis. So the jihadis are coming down and they're starting to attack in, you know, they're starting to mobilize in Ghana. There's been attacks in Ivory Coast, attacks in Togo. And then of course, Nigeria itself has a very long porous border with Niger, and Boko Haram, the terrorist group, have operated across the border. And in fact, Nigeria, Chad and Niger and a few other, Benin, a few other countries are part of a multinational joint task force that has been quite effective in breaking the back of Boko Haram. In fact, on both sides of the Nigerian border. So that the alarm that the West African states feel from this spreading coup contagion has got a lot to do with the fact that, you know, they themselves feel under threat. They've got a new president in Nigeria, Bola Tinubu, who came in May 29th. He's now, as of a month ago, he becomes chairman of ECOWAS. And the first thing he says, look, we're not going to tolerate coups anymore. Because part of the problem is that, you know, they've been asleep at the wheel for the past 3 years while these coups have been happening. They're like, we're going to have to draw a line in the sand. Our policy is zero tolerance. From now on, we're not going to tolerate it anymore. So you have this coup in Niger, and immediately, ECOWAS gathers in Abuja, capital of Nigeria. Tinubu is very strong on this. We are going to, you know, give them a week to stand down, you know, stop this, stop this hostage situation, you know, go back to constitutional government. And, that otherwise we're going to do a military intervention, which is something they've done in the past. Yeah.
I suspect what's going to happen. Correct me if I'm wrong, but ECOWAS is going to say you have a week. And then at the end of that week, well, we'll give you one more week to.
I think what happened is that after they did that, there was a mobilization that went on in Niamey, which is the capital of Niger, where basically, everybody suddenly was attending rallies because now the country was under threat. And so the military coup actually gained support. Also because there's a pro-Russian civil society group that was handing out Russian flags and saying Viva Putin. But it was deeper than that. 60% of the population of Niger is Hausa. The population of northern Nigeria is Hausa. So they're the same people, really. And for Tinubu and for Nigeria, it became a huge political problem. All the leading clerics went to see him and said, no, you can't do this. It was a deeply unpopular thing. He still has issues of, he had a very thin margin in his election. The election tribunal is still deciding, whether or not, the election was rigged. I presume they're going to come back and, throw out the challenge by the two opposition parties. But either way, I mean, he's on thin ice, at home. He's done some wrenching economic reforms, got rid of a petroleum subsidy and so on. So, there's a real cost of living crisis going on in Nigeria. So politically, it was impossible for him to do. And so with all this ratcheted up, there was, of course, a lot of media and a lot of disinformation about, oh, there's going to be a war and the Nigerians are kind of behind it. And Nigeria became, in that kind of disinformation context, like the new NATO, the same people who were sort of beating the drums, for war in Ukraine and pro-Russian stuff, were now kind of operating down there very effectively, actually. I think that, in terms of the information war, I mean, they were winning hands down. So ECOWAS had to kind of like take a different route. And I think the route that they've taken is what they call second channel kind of negotiation. So it's not kind of like direct. You send in, they tried at first to send in former head of state, and then they were going to send in a couple of heads of state from Togo and Ghana and so on. That's not going to work. The way it happens is with the clerics, the people of Niger, the Hausa around Niamey are essentially, they belong to one group of Muslims that are very powerful and strong in West Africa, the Tijani order. And in fact, the former governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, who was also the Emir of Kano at one point, he went up and he managed to get a meeting with the leaders, with General Chiani. He was the first one. And now the whole emphasis is sending these religious leaders to talk to their kinsmen, to talk to their people. And that, I think, is the route that ultimately they're going to go. And you did hear Chiani saying this week, that they're open to negotiations. They said at the same time that they're going to charge the president with treason, which is an interesting, I think that's a kind of negotiating tactic, because it's like, okay, we won't charge him with treason if you don't charge us with treason, ultimately, when you come to an agreement. And how you settle things, I think it'll be settled in a West African way, which is some kind of amnesty and maybe something else on offer to make it attractive for some of these generals to step down. That's my guess. Unfortunately, at the same time, they've kind of unleashed a kind of, I won't say an ethnic war, but they've given strength to the jihadists. And part of the complication of Niger is that the president, Bazoum, is an Arab. Very small minority of people in Niger are Arabs. But up in the north, in those great big sort of like desert wastes, people there are Tuareg, and there's Arabs as well. And the leader of those Tuaregs, who was a member of Bazoum's cabinet, is now saying, well, I'm against the coup and I'm going to restart the sort of, the Tuareg war against the government, the military guys down in the south. So you've unleashed that, and you've already got a very strong Al-Qaeda element operating in the north. And then at the same time, and not by accident, a group of, you know, the UN is pulling out of Mali, and a very sort of, a Tuareg kind of Arab group in the north of Mali is now, has actually been, fighting Wagner and Mali. I think it was a very big battle last Friday, and actually won. So it's kind of unleashed some other kind of issues in the region, which are very complicated and very, you know, once you start get into these dimensions of ethnic war, you're actually, you know, you're on a very slippery slope towards something quite horrendous.
I'm reminded of a book title came out, 20 some years ago by Robert Kaplan. You may recall Coming Anarchy, in which he posits all the different forces, whether it's climate or food security or ethnic tensions. And his argument basically is that many of these nations are almost doomed to slide into the kind of anarchy that you're describing, if for no other reason that the governments lack any sort of real capacity to deliver the kinds of services and security that one would expect of a government, and to exercise actual governmental control over their territory. The picture you're painting to me is one in which a whole swathe of countries from West Africa through to Sudan are in the throes of moving into less and less capable, organized, coherent, cogent governance and more potential ethnic rivalry. In the meantime, the climate and the agricultural questions loom ever larger. Then you throw in a dollop of the Wagner group and some remnant anti-colonialist rhetoric. The recipe is not very good, is it?
No, it's not. And you know, you're absolutely 100% right. I mean, climate change, Africa is the most vulnerable continent when it comes to climate change. And in fact, the Sahel is probably the most vulnerable part of Africa. You know, I mean, that Sahara Desert area is spreading. Desertification is a massive problem. But I want to mention something else, which I think is a big deal. And that is, it often gets forgotten. And that's the cost of living crisis that is being felt throughout Africa. And just to sort of again step back a little bit, you know, COVID happened, and many of the rich countries were able to spend their way out of COVID. And then on top of COVID, you had all this extra expenditure, which then you had inflation, then you had the central banks raising interest rates, and then you had the war with Russia invading Ukraine. Now, if you look at all of those factors together, you know, those are shocks to the global economy. And, you know, countries like the United States are better able to kind of deal with those shocks. The U.S. is doing rather well at the moment, actually. But, you know, most of Africa, apart from the fact that there's a massive debt crisis, a sovereign debt crisis going on, but the real crisis is when you go down to the street, when you see how ordinary Africans are battling. And we're not talking about, you know, kind of starving people out in the middle of, you know, the rural areas. We're talking about people in the cities, middle-class people, working-class people, people who are trying to get by. And I think we tend to underestimate that and not look at that as a factor, because it's not just the Sahel. You know, there's unrest in Kenya. There's unrest in Senegal. You know, Sudan had 600% inflation or something at the point that it went into civil war. And these are not factors that are often taken into account. But in some way, you know, the international community has to find a way to cushion the most vulnerable people in the world from these shocks, because otherwise, you know, what we're seeing, I think has a lot to do with the economic conditions of ordinary Africans.
We're speaking with Philip von Niekerk, former editor of the Mail and Guardian, of course, now ensconced in Washington, where he is the editorial control for Scroll Africa. He operates a consulting business to advise investors on the circumstances and possibilities in Africa. And he is painting a somewhat less than rosy picture for us of the Sahel, not without hope, but certainly not something where you could just wish it away and say it's all being taken care of, no problem, just keep moving along, don't look here. We'll be right back after this message. and we're on the deep dive.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
We're speaking with Philip Van Niekerk of Scrolla Africa, which goes into various African countries, and he says he's got a million subscribers to it now, or a million viewers, which is quite something.
Mm-hmm.
A million readers. President of Calabar Africa, which is a consulting company, and newly launched Africa Unscrambled, a weekly newsletter. Is there a role, an appropriate role, for South Africa in any of this? The country's had a sort of an up and down set of experiences dealing with problems in Mozambique and in the Central African Republic. But in these other nations, is there some place appropriately for South Africa? Not necessarily militarily, but in some other fashion. What is your feeling on that?
Okay, well, what tends to happen in West Africa is that ECOWAS takes the lead, and the African Union, of which South Africa is a key member, essentially supports ECOWAS. So I think that there's certainly a role for South Africa to support. But I think there's also a discussion we can have about the role that regional organizations like SADC or ECOWAS or the East African Community can have in sort of policing the behavior of its own members. So I don't see that South Africa has a direct role, though I do see that there's a lot of information about Sahel that's coming down to South Africa. And I think where it's having an impact is a lot of the disinformation has sort of created the idea that some of these military leaders are actually kind of almost hero figures. Particularly the leader of Burkina Faso is a man called Ibrahim Traore. And he fashions himself on the previous Burkinabe leader, Thomas Sankara, who was assassinated allegedly with the connivance of the French back in the 1980s. He's 34 and he's, think Julius Malema with a uniform on. And he was at the recent Russia-Africa conference standing next to Putin with his beret, very kind of looking very chic. You know, if you look at social media, he's picked up a lot of support inside South Africa and across the continent. So the sort of ramifications of the sort of ideological and information war that's going on there is kind of touching us in South Africa as well. And, you know, we need to be aware of that. We need to, you know, kind of understand it because, you know, it could be quite disturbing in terms of, the kind of support that some people are displaying for military coups and for military leadership. Where South Africa comes in, I mean, it's, you know, ECOWAS clearly failed to, you know, back in 2017, they intervened in Gambia, when the previous president was trying to, prevent, had lost an election and was trying to stop, you know, he was doing a Trump on Gambia, and the ECOWAS said that's unacceptable, and they went in and they forced him to hand over to the winners of that democratic election. But since then, they've been very, very lax in terms of one coup after the other happening and really having a very weak response to the coups. And the weaker you are, the more likely it is you're actually starting to enable coups, because the coup leader is saying, well, nobody's going to give me a hard time. All I got to do is, you know, just take out the guns and march into the palace. And I think in a way, there was an enabling environment that allowed Niger to happen. So what are the lessons we learn? We've got an election in Zimbabwe next week. I would say that the question marks against how democratic it's going to be, given the manipulations by ZANU-PF, make it, again, kind of raise questions about how does a regional organization actually, you know, even according to its own protocols, according to its own principles, police its members. And I think ECOWAS, I think Tinubu got ahead of his skis at first, but I think they're trying to sort of, show, well, how can you get African, if you're going to get truly African solutions to some of the crises on the continent, and it's not going to be about the great powers, you're going to have to find new ways of engaging and ensuring, you know, that, better behavior is happening. Otherwise, you're all going to be threatened.
Back in the 50s and 60s, I'm old enough to remember that, the 1950s and 60s, there was a great deal of credit placed on the idea of the domino theory, most especially for East and Southeast Asia, part of the American political and diplomatic elite, that if one country fell to the communists, the next country fell, would be more likely to fall and so forth, like a row of dominoes tipping over one after the other after the other, until at the end of the process, it was all held by a hostile power. What you're saying to me has a slight, but I think the difference might be that because of the porousness of the various borders between the countries of the region, and because the ethnicities straddle the borders, as you say, the Hausa are on various sides of borders and so forth, that there is a kind of a domino effect that if in one country a coup is successful, it gives a little bit of stiffening and a little bit of heart to the militias or the army in a neighboring country to see if they might want to try this process. Am I going in the right direction, barking up?
No, I think that's correct. I mean, I think if the regional bodies, if the AU, if nobody is going to call them out, and they can reach out and get support, you know, as Mali did from Wagner or other kind of forces, then yeah, it does. You have a thing called coup contagion. But I'd sort of come back, I think, to the idea that there are sort of three major sort of geopolitical factors that are happening. I mean, the first is all of the countries in the Sahel where you've had problems like this are former French colonies. And so we really have to sort of understand it in the context of this almost collapse of Françafrique, which has been the dominant power in that area for the last 60 years. Second of all, you've got the jihadists, who are, extending their influence, through, Burkina Faso. It's like, I think they're 30-40% now of the territory is sort of controlled by, you know, jihadist elements. You see where Al-Qaeda, you've got ISIS, you've got a number of different, I mean, this is now, the world, it's a very poor region, is now the world epicenter of global extremism. And that's a very important factor. And then you've got the Ukraine war, affecting, the fact that, you know, Russia sees what a part of the world that generally wouldn't be very interesting to them as a great opportunity to score some propaganda victory over the West, and also to make a big deal out of the, you know, out of the French and the Americans, who have a big base up in Niger. They've got two bases, actually. One that they've just spent $100 million on. It's a big drone base that, they use to surveil the great wastes of the Sahara that have been used to actually help fight the insurgents. And I think they're a little bit, the Americans, Washington's a little bit nervous about what happens next as well. And taking actually a decidedly different line to the French, on that whole story. So, you know, those are all factors. Now, I mean, what's interesting about the Russian engagement is the Russian engagement is through Wagner. The Russia will not, you know, kind of send its own troops or actually, you know, kind of engage directly. So you've got Wagner, which is a hybrid organization. They go for, big commercial opportunities, particularly in mining. They're mercenaries. But they're also tied into Russian military intelligence, so that they can be all of these things, and some other serve the purpose of Russian foreign policy, which is to embarrass, and show up the West. And I think they're very, very effective in the kind of propaganda they do. And ultimately they're a big kind of criminal organization, really, which is not very helpful at the end of the day to Africans, but, you know, in the kind of disinformation and propaganda, they are able to actually put forward a narrative which a lot of people accept and at face value.
We're speaking with Philip van Niekerk. He is the editorial director of Scrolla Africa, and many South Africans will remember him from his time as editor of the Mail and Guardian. He is head of a consulting group, Calabar Africa, and as he informed me, something I should have known, which I didn't, but which I now do, that he is now putting together a newsletter once a week for my own organization, Isn't that interesting? Daily Maverick, his newsletter is Africa Unscrambled, reversing the Berlin conference, I guess, and looking at things as they are now and helping us to get an honest view. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back after this word.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and we're finishing off our conversation with Philip von Niekerk, Scrolla Africa editorial director, running the new newsletter, Africa Unscrambled, head of Calabar Africa, the consulting firm, and formerly the editor of the Mail and Guardian. We've been talking about the Sahel and the strategic and political and, to some important degree, the economic and climatological challenges in the region circulating around the run of coups that have happened. But I want to shift gears for just a minute. I caught an article that you had written some weeks ago about South Africa's representation in Washington diplomatically. What I would have referred to essentially as the diplomatic gap, not gaffe, but gap, with an ambassador who was resident but ill and unavailable for participation just at the time that relations between the two countries were in a particular kind of awkward stage. She will be replaced now by somebody else, but I want you to think a little bit, think about and offer some ideas. What should South Africa, how should the government position itself with a new ambassador? What kind of person should there be? Where should they come from rather than the ranks of retired politicians, say?
Well, look, I think there are a few senior diplomats, who are in the service who could potentially, do very well. As I said, I think in the piece, we just go for retreaded politicians. We're not taking the task seriously. South Africa has a huge challenge in Washington. I don't think they quite realize how steep that challenge is and what the costs are if they don't correct it. And I think the course correction is very possible. I would say, ideally it would be somebody like, Patrice Motsepe, it would be somebody who, has a profile, who understands business, understands, because it's a very important, it is a very important economic relationship. I know some people shrug off AGOA. I don't think we're going to lose AGOA privileges. Not in this round anyway, but, cause the State Department ultimately decides and they determine not to, even though in Congress there's a great amount of dissatisfaction and distrust of South Africa's relationship with Russia. But I do think, the thing about AGOA is that it's manufacturing jobs. It's not just buying. I mean, right. Most of China's trade with Africa is buying oil, buying raw materials. That those figures that they say, China's, it's much more than the U.S., but the U.S. kind of the privileges that are afforded by AGOA. It's the motor car industry in the Eastern Cape. And all the parts industries in Botswana and the surrounding countries. And I don't think we've even made sufficient use of the fact that we've got that tariff free and it's a non-reciprocal thing. We don't put lower tariffs on US products coming into South Africa. It's something that really kind of matters, and potentially 100,000 jobs, manufacturing jobs, could be lost if we lose it. And also there's so many other kind of, potentially, I think what people lose, in this whole kind of ideological debate is that, the United States and South Africa are very similar in many ways. I don't say they're exactly the same because demographically, different in a lot of ways, but South Africa, if I go to South Africa, I see American culture everywhere. There's a natural kind of affinity, and it would be a real pity if, because a few, political people, at the top of the ANC or the ANC International Affairs Committee, think that it's, basically are still seeing the world through the eyes of the Cold War, that we lose the opportunities that come from, you know, those kind of relationships at a kind of a much deeper level.
When you say Patrice Motsepe, I don't know whether you could see this. We're talking via video link. I don't know whether you saw me smiling. That'd be an extraordinary appointment. But I think back to the dying days of apartheid in the beginning of the New Order. Harry Swartz was an appointee as ambassador to the U.S., and he knew his way around the world and banking and business. And one of his immediate predecessor, I believe, was Franklin Sohn, who also knew his way around the world and the way of business. And one of his successors was Barbara Masakela, who had taught in the U.S. for 20 years, had lived there, and she knew her way around America and had a wide range of acquaintances. And even more recently, Ibrahim Rasool, although he was a former politician, had an understanding of business and international relations. There needs to be a better look at a wider gene pool, I think, on what constitutes an ambassador or a diplomatic representative in the current age, rather than simply, ah, yes, this person has done loyal service for us for 40 years as a politician. They need a vacation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I quite agree with you about Rasool, by the way. He was a very effective ambassador. He engaged and he kind of just went out a lot, and it made a difference to have him here. The other thing is, which I kind of mentioned in the piece, is that there's a growing South African diaspora in the United States. There are, you know, I mean, increasingly, and where 20 years ago, the kind of people you would see in the United States were kind of wenwis who were kind of happy to get out of South Africa and complained all the time. You know, there's actually a very strong, you know, community of South Africans in Washington and in, you know, throughout the country, actually in Houston, in Austin, in Boston, in California, in the Silicon Valley, you know, who are actually pretty supportive of South Africa. And the, you know, the embassy hasn't really engaged those people or brought them in to kind of the relationships. And I mean, I mentioned, you know, Trevor Noah, you know, who's a real big star here, you know, Pretty Yendi, you know, the opera singer, you know, and there are many, many others. And I don't mention, I'm not including Elon Musk in that list.
He's made his mark a different way. Philip, I'm going to have to draw this to a conclusion, unfortunately, because we've run out of time. We've been speaking with Philip van Niekerk of Scrolla Africa, Africa Unscrambled, Calabar Africa, and formerly Mail and Guardian editor years gone by, and an astute and careful observer of things Africa and things in America as they relate to Africa. And that's an important dimension that I think far too few people pay much attention to. And it's been important, I think, to have this conversation. And I look forward to doing this again with you in the future.
Thanks, Brooks. Great chatting. See you.